From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. In one of his first acts as Senate Majority Leader, Democrat Chuck Schumer said today that the House will send a single article of impeachment to the Senate on Monday. Doing so will trigger the start of former President Trump's second impeachment trial. This time he's charged with inciting the rioters that stormed the U.S. Capitol building.
And to talk all about this, we have for our Friday's Politics Roundtable, Scott Wong, who is senior staff writer at The Hill, and Beth Fooey, who is a senior politics editor at NBC News and MSNBC. Welcome to you both.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
Beth, I'll start with you. Biden's inaugural message was about unity. That, of course, was on Wednesday. Today, there is this news about the impeachment trial. How is bipartisanship holding up in Washington right now?
Well, as you've mentioned, the word unity seems to be sort of a trigger right now for Republicans who are complaining already about President Biden and some of his appointments being very liberal in terms of his cabinet nominees. The fact that he put forth an immigration plan that many Republicans say is going to go nowhere on the Hill. And he also announced some LGBTQ protections in the last couple of days. So obviously he is pursuing some issues that are important to folks on the left side of his base. But let's face it, unity doesn't mean that everything has to be a compromise. The vision that he seems to be setting forth is that we can agree to disagree, we can hammer out our issues and maybe come to some consensus, but that doesn't mean that everything needs to be a straight down the middle, parsing everything into halves and one half or the other. So that's going to be something Republicans are going to have to wrestle with. And obviously, you know, Biden is a Democrat. He was elected as a moderate to progressive Democrat, and he's not going to step back from that just to sort of look like a compromiser.
Okay, let's get into the timing of this impeachment trial hearing. On the Senate floor this morning, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell pointed out that he asked for the trial to start later on February 11th. Let's listen.
That timeline would have provided the Senate some more floor time before we step up fully into the unknown of a trial, which, by the way, would have been a substantial benefit to the incoming administration and allowed them to get more of their cabinet confirmed.
Okay, the timing has been scrambled, though. Just this morning, the Senate confirmed President Biden's second cabinet pick, Lloyd Austin, who will become the first Black American defense secretary. But that aside, what more, Scott, can you tell us about what an impeachment trial will look like and how long it may last?
Well, we actually don't know. What we can say today is that Chuck Schumer, the new majority leader, said he talked to Nancy Pelosi, who informed him that they will be sending over this single article of impeachment charging Trump with inciting an insurrection against the Capitol to the Senate on Monday. And as you mentioned, that immediately starts the clock on an impeachment trial. What it means is that the Senate needs to take it up and dispense with the trial before it tackles any other major business. Now, you know, one of the big hangups is whether or not there can be some kind of agreement between Schumer and McConnell on a deal to allow for what this new buzzword in Washington is called bifurcation, where you would tackle part of the Senate trial during the early part of the day and then maybe turn to confirmations and other legislative business during the afternoon. But so far, that doesn't seem to be that seems to be a non-starter with McConnell. He's holding firm. There are a bunch of elements to any sort of bipartisan deal right now. McConnell wants to preserve the filibuster, that 60-vote threshold on any sort of legislation. Democrats are hoping, including many, many progressives, are hoping to eliminate that 60-vote threshold for legislation. And so then there are a bunch of different elements tied up in any sort of future bipartisan deal. And that seems to be what's dictating the timeline and why we're sort of at an impasse right now between McConnell and Chuck Schumer.
Beth, the other question is, once that Senate trial gets started, how are Republicans going to respond? Just last week, The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said that former President Trump does bear some responsibility for the riots. But then yesterday he said this.
I don't believe he provoked if you listen to what he said at the rally.
Okay, so what do you make of that? Are Republicans kind of cooling off on holding Trump responsible for those riots at the Capitol?
Well, yes, McCarthy may have said that, but the person who matters in this case is Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader. And he laid the blame very squarely at President Trump's feet in a floor speech just the other day. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that enough Republicans will come along to vote with Democrats to convict former President Trump. McConnell has said that he would listen to the arguments presented at the trial and then make his decision. But we already have heard from several Republicans who say, look, he's a former president. Why are we going through this motion for somebody who's not even in office anymore, not even in power? Let's move on. It will certainly trigger a lot of those, you know, very tense feelings and emotions that seem to hover over the Trump presidency for all 4 years of sort of this very sort of divisive, angry pose that we had in our politics that now President Biden is saying he wants to eliminate. So it will trigger another very sort of partisan moment up there on the Hill. And yet, remember that all those senators who are going to be making a decision about President Trump's fate were in the Senate chamber when the rioters mm-hmm. came through, and their safety and perhaps their lives were threatened. So this is a case where the jury is actually witness to the crime, and that may make some Republicans think long and hard about whether to acquit him.
Well, to that point, Scott, Senate Democrats have filed an ethics complaint against Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, asking that they're investigated for their role in what happened at the Capitol that day. Is that going anywhere? And where do we stand with other Republicans facing political consequences for objecting to the Electoral College vote certification after the riot?
Yeah, I think all of those incidents really underscore the civil war that is happening within the Republican Party after that Trump speech at the White House and the subsequent insurrection at the Capitol just moments later. I was in the Capitol at that time, and throughout that entire day, it was extremely terrifying few hours for everybody, the lawmakers and reporters and staff involved there. And so we are seeing the fallout right now, and you're seeing, you know, some Republicans that are standing by. More than, 140 Republicans in those moments after the attack stood by the president and contested the results of the elections in Arizona and Pennsylvania. And you're seeing fallout from the people who led that effort to undermine the will of the voters. And you're also seeing fallout for people like Liz Cheney, who have stood up and voted to impeach the president. She is, of course, the number three Republican leader in the House. There were 10 of them in the House of Representatives, Republicans, who voted to impeach. And that has provided some more cover for any Republicans in the Senate who may want to vote to convict. Right now, we think there's only going to be a handful of those people, perhaps five or six Republicans who are in that convict column, which simply will not be enough. They need at least 17. But it does show the divide that's happened in the Republican Party in the wake of these events. And, you know, it's going to underscore this divide as we go on in this post-Trump world about what's going to happen to the Republican Party and or this idea that Trump may perhaps create a party of his own called the Patriot Party.
Yeah, can we talk about that, though? I mean, he left Washington this week and he vowed to be back in some form. What are you hearing about his future on the Hill? Do Republicans actually want him to keep leading the GOP?
I'm not sure that Republicans want him to continue leading the Republican Party. I think many people are following the president and continuing to follow the president because of a fear of the president. He has shown in the past that he can exact retribution on people who are not loyal to him. That happened during the course of 4 years, where we saw a number of people lose their political careers, including Jeff Flake and Mark Sanford, who decided to stand up against him. And so I think that it all traces back to a fear of the president and what he possibly could mean to the futures of their political careers.
With the minute I have with both of you, much is being said about Dr. Anthony Fauci saying yesterday that he now feels free to actually tell the hard truths about what's ahead in fighting this coronavirus. Beth, what do you make of Fauci's comparison of the two different administrations?
Well, it's pretty clear that Dr. Fauci was frustrated working under President Trump. I mean, he was always very quick to say that he and Trump had a cordial relationship, but he was running smack into the fact that President Trump was downplaying the severity of the virus, was not advocating strongly for the wearing of masks. In fact, he would mock that occasionally. That just flew in the face of public health guidance from everyone, and in particular from the guy who was supposedly heading this up for President Trump, Dr. Fauci. Yeah. So it's not surprising that he is stepping forward forcefully to talk about this virus in a way that he hasn't been able to up until this point.
Beth Fooey, thank you so much. And Scott Wong, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
President Biden has already taken executive action on the pandemic, the economy, and immigration. But how will the new administration handle big tech? That's the question Elizabeth Dwoskin has been looking into. She's a Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Hey, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Tanya.
Okay, so as we know, Joe Biden was vice president for 8 years during the Obama administration. And that's when many of today's tech giants actually saw their greatest growth and accumulation of power. How is Biden's stance on tech different now than it was back then?
Absolutely. And Tanya, remember that Biden was vice president during the administration that effectively allowed Facebook to merge with WhatsApp and Instagram. This was the administration that declined to pursue an antitrust case against Google. Now, there are antitrust cases against Facebook and Google that were launched during the Trump administration. Even before the Capitol riots, I thought it was going to be a sea change for big tech. Now that Democrats have won both houses of Congress, and the Capitol insurrection has taken place, which was largely organized on social media platforms, I couldn't imagine a more intense climate for and a more friendly climate for calling for regulating these massive tech giants, which have essentially in the last decade become the largest companies in the world.
Mm-hmm. I want to get more specific, but you mentioned these antitrust lawsuits against Google and Facebook that the Trump administration took on. Is the Biden administration expected to keep those going?
Yes. As one of my best sources on this topic said, the train has left the station. You know, Biden specifically has been on the record himself being very critical of Silicon Valley and basically pleading with Facebook in June to stop Trump from publishing what he said were wild claims, to do more fact-checking, to crack down on misinformation. So I think, you know, Biden really personally in some ways has it out for Facebook right now. And no one expects that case to let up. And, you know, if you compare it to the Microsoft case, which lasted 10 years and several presidential administrations, I think Facebook is scrambling right now and they're viewing it in that same way.
Let's talk about some other issues. What about Section 230? This is the longstanding law that shields internet companies from liability for content posted by users. Conservatives have called for it to be repealed. Are we any closer to that happening?
And not just conservatives. Biden himself has said that the law should be scrapped. And people in his inner orbit have also said that publicly. But then it comes to the question of, okay, the Democrats and the left in this country, they want social media to be regulated on issues like hate speech and misinformation. And the right is very concerned with political bias, which given the First Amendment that exists in the United States, it would be very hard, almost impossible to get tech companies to regulate political speech. But there are some precedents for regulating forms of hate speech. And so you can see in some world where tech companies are really held to account when people are inciting violence on their platforms. By law, you know, we can look at what's going on in other countries and say maybe there are some other ways that we can regulate tech that isn't going to, you know, shut down the industry as we know it. However, I will add there that, and this is important, that Facebook is a massive company. Google is a massive company. And what we've seen, even with privacy laws, big companies that are very well financed are able to withstand regulation and shape regulation. They've spent tens of million dollars in lobbying already. But then you have smaller companies that are protected by Section 230, the eBays, the Yelps of the world. And those companies aren't necessarily going to have the money to fend off all the lawsuits that would inevitably come their way and can't necessarily afford to fight back.
Oh, this is really interesting and actually very important to parse out as we have this discussion. How has Silicon Valley more broadly been preparing for what could be more regulation?
Everyone is trying to read the tea leaves based on who Biden hires, based on what other priorities are happening in Washington. I think everyone recognizes that the biggest priority for the country is the COVID-19 crisis. And if there's any major priority, the most major priority in tech might actually be cybersecurity, because there was this enormous hack which came in the midst of all this other news. But, you know, Biden has already said he's going to appoint a cybersecurity czar, and we'll pay attention to that issue. I think on the issues around white nationalism and terrorism as a result of the Capitol riots, well, that's one area that tech tends to take its cues from Washington. And take the example of ISIS. When federal agencies and law enforcement got very serious about ISIS, they created these historic partnerships where they were sending materials and really holding the tech company's hands and saying, we're looking for this crap on your platforms, help us find it. And the tech companies had a template to do that, and then they went with it. They got permission from the government. They didn't lead. Mm-hmm. They didn't go after ISIS on their own. They were told to. So we've never had a model like that for domestic terrorism. And so if the U.S. government gets more serious about those issues, they may create some kind of partnership that gives the tech companies both a template and cover to start going after extremism on their platforms in a way that they haven't so far, and would really test some of the commitments they've made to free speech.
Elizabeth Jawaskin is Silicon Valley correspondent for The Washington Post. Elizabeth, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, with a new president in the White House, late-night talk show hosts may have less material to work with. Anti-Trump jokes and diatribes have become a regular staple for comedians in the past 4 years. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here now to discuss the future of late-night TV without Donald Trump to kick around. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
Donald Trump could really get Stephen Colbert fired up at The Late Show. Here he is the night after the Capitol insurrection.
This is the most shocking, most tragic, least surprising thing I've ever seen. For years now, people have been telling you cowards that if you let the president lie about our democracy over and over and then join him in that lie and say he's right when you know for a fact that he is not, there will be a terrible price to pay. But you just never thought you'd have to pay it, too.
Now that their muse is out of the White House, what do you think Colbert and other late-night hosts are going to do?
Their muse is out of the White House, but he's not necessarily out of trouble. There's still going to be an impeachment trial. And, of course, we have the pandemic. And, of course, we have all the political fights that are going to result from the Biden administration's efforts. Trump liked to be at the center of the conversation all the time. And I think a lot of people just got worn out by that. And so the question will be, how can the late night host kind of calibrate what they're doing to meet that feeling, you know, where people may kind of be tired of the really intense talk about politics and may want them to find a new direction?
You're right. I mean, many of these comedians had to take on the more serious role of political commentator with Trump in the White House. I know you've been keeping an eye on the new Amber Ruffin show. How did she handle the former president?
What I love about Amber is that she's always trying to get people to see things from the perspective of people of color and women of color, especially. And she had a great routine about enjoying the fact that white supremacists were being held to account. And I think we have a clip of it.
Is it the way you think it's okay to smash up the Capitol building? Is it the way you think you're innocent? 'Cause you just helped.
I'm waiting for years for a change. Now it's starting to shift. I feel so ashamed, but I must admit that there's an appeal to how you make me feel. Your sadness fills me with joy.
So, yeah, she loves doing these sort of takeoffs on R&B songs and things like that. Yeah. But the point of that one was just enjoying this environment where white supremacists were being held to account. So Amber has staked out, you know, a unique position.
Yeah, Eric, what about Jimmy Fallon at The Tonight Show? You know, this is a guy who's been criticized for a while for going easy on Trump, all the way back to 2016 when he messed up Trump's hair during that interview. How did Fallon's approach to Trump end up serving him in the end?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Jimmy Fallon, as talented as he is, and I think he is talented, comes across as a kind of a phony and kind of a lightweight. I think he has had trouble meeting the moment of both Trump and the coronavirus. We have a little clip of one of his monologues. Let's sample his comedy.
It feels like the country is back. Sure, the GPS took us on some crazy back road for the last 4 years, but now we're back on Main Street and we can tell people we were lost.
Eric, I can kind of hear what you mean there.
Yeah, you know, he's not really imparting any new information. He's just telling a funny joke, which, you know, a few years ago in late night might have been enough. But these days, it really isn't. And so I think he's got to hope that the tenor of the times change a little bit, because otherwise he's still going to feel like he's not meeting the moment.
The shows we're talking about pretty much universally reviled Donald Trump, and as far as I can tell, really made no effort to reach out to anyone who voted for him over the last 4 years. Do you think that does any damage to those shows? And do you think that, you know, maybe now that Trump is gone, it would help them to broaden their audiences again? What do you think about that?
Well, I think the bottom line is, to be successful in late night, you have to have a sense of reality and what you're talking about. And I think it's hard to do that and also reach out to a constituency that insists on believing things that are demonstrably untrue. I think the bigger question is, will late night audiences retain their appetite for very serious, grounded commentary, or will they want something that is a little more fun and a little less obsessed with the headlines? And, you know, all of these people have proven that they're capable of that kind of work. And whether or not they can shift to meet that moment is going to be their challenge, I think.
NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks as always. Have a good weekend.
Always a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business. Apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
President Biden campaigned on uniting the country. He now takes office just weeks after a pro-Trump insurrection. The NPR Politics podcast is there every day to break down the transition of power as Biden takes the reins in Washington.
Baseball has lost another legend. Hall of Famer Henry Hank Aaron has died at the age of 86. Aaron is best remembered for breaking Babe Ruth's career run home run record in 1974. Aaron's Atlanta Braves were playing the Los Angeles Dodgers when he hit home run number 715.
Fastball is a high drive into deep left center field. Buckner goes back to the fence. It is gone.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman joins us now to talk more about Hank Aaron. And Tom, what a legend. What place will he hold in baseball history?
Yeah. Hi, Tanya. An enormous place. One of the greatest and most consistent hitters ever in the history of the game. He wasn't a huge guy, by the way. A lot of his power came from his wrists, which he once said he developed when he was younger, helping his family out, earning money by delivering ice around Mobile, Alabama, where he grew up. You can see the consistency in the numbers. He reached the 300 mark in batting and higher in 14 seasons. He had at least 30 home runs 15 times. He had at least 90 runs batted in 16 seasons. He was a good fielder, too. 3 Gold Glove Awards. And he was chosen for the All-Star Game 25 times. Now, he played 23 years, but some years they had 2 All-Star Games in one season. So statistically, he was, just amazing, really.
25 times. Yeah, amazing. You mentioned his childhood and delivering ice. His family was so poor when he was a kid that he didn't have baseball equipment. He would tell this story of how he honed his skills by hitting bottle caps with a stick. As we know, he started his career in the Negro Leagues. And when he was chasing Babe Ruth's home run record, he experienced death threats and, of course, racism. I mean, it's actually extraordinary, all of his accomplishments in spite of it all.
It was pretty ghastly what he endured. He received thousands of letters filled with vile hate and racism when it became clear he was going to challenge Babe Ruth's record. And he once said about it, "They think they'll upset me with their words or their shouts, that they'll get me where I can't do the job. This won't happen. I don't like it, but I always do my best. This only makes me more determined." He also said he wished he could have enjoyed it as much as others who broke records. It was interesting, Tanya. Sports Illustrated reported that on the night that he did it, when he broke the record in Atlanta in April 1974, his bodyguard was disguised as a fan, ready with a gun hidden in a binoculars case. Oh. And there were police snipers on the stadium roof. And according to Sports Illustrated, fortunately, they showed life-saving judgment when two teenagers jumped out of the stands to join Aaron during his run around the bases. We all remember that iconic moment.
What a story. As I said at the top, baseball has lost another great legend. There's so many who we have lost in this last year or so. Hank Aaron
Absolutely.
Tops the list. Yeah.
Absolutely.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hank Aaron, dead at the age of 86. There was a time when Lil Wayne was declared himself the best rapper alive. And with more than a dozen top singles, fans didn't blink an eye at his hubris. Well, Lil Wayne's place in hip-hop is undeniable. But that doesn't answer the reasons why he and several hip-hop figures ended up on former President Donald Trump's list of pardons and commutations. To explore this question, we're joined by Sydney Madden. She's editor of NPR Music and host of Louder Than a Riot, a podcast that explores the intersection of hip-hop and mass incarceration. Sydney, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So of the 143 names on this list of pardons, there was Lil Wayne, who was charged with felony gun possession, Kodak Black, a rapper who was serving a sentence for lying on a federal gun background check, Desiree Perez, the chief executive of JC's Roc Nation, and Michael Harris, founder of Death Row Records. He's been in prison for 30 years. Mm-hmm. What is the connection between these hip-hop figures and Donald Trump?
The connections between hip-hop and Donald Trump, it's always had a symbiotic relationship, and it's a bit ubiquitous how these names wound up on the list of pardons and official commutations from Trump, but there's a reason that Kodak Black and Lil Wayne's names really stick out here. They're both federal cases, and both parties, both Southern rappers, are rep by the same lawyer, Bradford Cohen, who is a former contestant on Donald Trump's, it seems so long ago, but yes, he was a reality star, everyone. His old reality show, The Apprentice. Yes, he was on the inaugural season. As you said, Wayne's federal case, it had to do with seizing of weapons from his private plane, a charge that he pleaded guilty to and faced up to a year and decade. But thanks to Trump's official pardon, he won't be serving any time. And in Kodak's case, it was about, as you said, falsifying info and things like name, age, who would be owning the gun, on paperwork to buy a gun, which he's been serving since 2019. Both these cases came to light on the last week of Trump's presidency, but they really culminated long, weeks-long, sometimes months-long campaigns, letter writing, people like Deion Sanders, Vanilla Ice, Lil Yachty, others in the hip-hop community and in the entertainment community went to bat for both of these rappers, writing letters talking about their community enrichment ideals, things like sponsoring young children's program. So they really painted both of these men in a favorable light in order to get these pardons and commutations through, seemingly at the last minute.
And you mentioned the other troubles of Kodak Black. He still faces a 2016 state charge of sexual assault in South Carolina. As part of your podcast, though, you explore the intersection of hip hop and mass incarceration. What was your first reaction to these pardons?
My initial reaction to these pardons was, you just got to follow the money. You know, during Trump's campaign, he did kind of dole out a few key artists in the hip hop community who he thought would cull votes from Black America. Lil Wayne was someone who endorsed him. The Florida rapper Lil Pump, who Trump referred to as Lil Pimp, also endorsed him at a public rally. So I think the amount of eyebrows that this raised, it shows you that even if you're the biggest rapper alive, no one is above reproach if you're going to align yourself with someone who's been especially unkind to the Black community.
What does it say about Trump's view or perception of Black America that he chose these rappers and executives over the other untold number of perhaps more compelling cases with real evidence of innocence?
I think it says that he's actually really far out of touch with Black America. It's clear that Trump is not listening to the top 40 or has his finger on the pulse of hip hop culture, because if he did, he would know how much Kodak Black is actually not in hip hop's good graces right now. He would know how many people kind of disregarded Lil Wayne's endorsement of him during the election by and large. It doesn't really compute with where the culture is at this moment.
And within the music industry, how are people feeling about this? There are mixed feelings about this. Many view Trump as a problematic figure to be accepting this last-minute help from. Desiree Perez, CEO of Roc Nation, who was granted a full pardon for her crime, says she's thankful, but when she was asked how she feels about Donald Trump, she made a point to say she does not want to talk about her feelings about him or her politics at all. What are you hearing from segments of the hip-hop industry?
Absolutely. I mean, Trump's fraught relationship with hip-hop and Black America at large, I mean, it's loomed for a long time before his presidency. But to that point, on the other side of the coin, people like Desiree Perez of Roc Nation had all but good things to say, but didn't want to say too much because he's just such a divisive figure. And yet, again, like I said, he has so much power that he can do these things like pardon. But I would say far and wide, most people in hip hop don't believe that these pardons or commutations do anything for hip hop at large.
That was Sydney Madden, editor at NPR Music and co-host of Louder Than a Riot, a podcast that explores the intersection of hip hop and mass incarceration. Sydney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This inauguration week has been filled with firsts, and we wanted to listen back to some of those important moments in American history.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
I, Kamala Davy Harris, do solemnly swear.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
The chair lays before the Senate two certificates of election for the state of Georgia and a certificate of appointment to fill the vacancy created by the resignation of former Senator Kamala D. Harris of California. Yeah, that was very weird. Okay.
Mr. Ossoff. Mr. Padilla, Mr. Warnock.
Please raise your right hand. Okay. Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you are about to enter, so help you God.
I do.
Congratulations.
I mentioned the historic nature of Vice President Harris's ascendance, but let's not forget that her successor, Alex Padilla, is the first Latino senator to represent California. That Raphael Warnock, born while Georgia was represented in this chamber by two staunch segregationists, is now first African-American senator Georgia has ever elected. And that John Ossoff is the first Jewish senator from his state.
I faced a lot of challenges as a goalkeeper on the Vanderbilt University women's soccer team and as a kicker on the football team. But seeing other women break barriers and be the first at what they do inspired me and gave me the strength to succeed. And that's why it is such an honor to introduce a true groundbreaker. And after 232 years of waiting, being able to say these words, our nation's first woman Vice President Kamala Harris.
The dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother can dream of becoming president, only to find herself reciting for one.
Sounds from this week of firsts, starting with Kamala Harris sworn in as the first woman and first black and first Asian American vice president, who then swore in three new Democratic senators. You also heard Chuck Schumer's first speech as Senate Majority Leader, groundbreaking college football player Sarah Fuller, and finally 22-year-old Amanda Gorman, the youngest inaugural poet in U.S. history, reciting her poem, The Hill We Climb, a week like no other. You're listening to Here and Now. Devotees of the online conspiracy theory QAnon are reckoning with the inauguration of President Biden, an event that their digital prophet, known as Q, had said would never happen. Q followers falsely believed the ceremony was a front for the military, acting on the orders of former President Trump to round up supposed members of the deep state. Ben Collins has been following this for NBC News. And Ben, can you explain this a little more deeply? What exactly did followers of QAnon think was going to happen at the swearing in of Joe Biden?
Yeah, until the very last second, until he took the oath of office, QAnon believers thought that this was basically an elaborate setup, that Joe Biden would be rounded up, so would Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and all these people who they viewed to be part of the deep state, that they would be turned on by the military, they would be rounded up and then executed on live television. They really did believe this. And a lot of people were looking forward to it. And then, you know, it didn't come. It sounds disgusting that they would think like a mass execution would be a big present to them. But that's what they really believed.
So clearly it didn't come. How do they square that with their worldview? I mean, are they disillusioned?
Yeah, they had a really hard time. They felt betrayed in real time. You know, I was watching these forums and these private chats on Telegram where QAnon supporters had met for months, and they had moved back their doomsday five or six times over the last few years. But this was their last hurrah. And they really did think, since everybody was going to be in one place, that they would all be rounded up. They had talked themselves into this shared delusion together. So when it became noon, Joe Biden was the president, it was very hard for them to square this. And, you know, some of them just dumped off entirely. They said, you know, we got duped, we got had. And others, you know, they tried to look for answers in ridiculous places. They tried to find, you know, maybe he was sworn in before noon, so he's not really the president, and there's a shadow presidency or something. But that group of people is getting smaller and smaller. They are getting more radicalized, but they're getting smaller and smaller.
Well, in fact, there are some people who will never have enough evidence to give up on the conspiracy theories. What do we know about them? Are they doubling down? What are they saying?
Yeah, so there are like two kinds of deniers at this point. There are deniers who are going that mystic route, who just firmly will never believe that Joe Biden is the president. And then there's the scarier part. You know, there are people who are disillusioned by this but don't want to give it up. You know, QAnon supporters, they're not going to go and like suddenly have a good media diet after this. They're not going to go home and, you know, pore over all actual factual information. And white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups know this. You know, in fact, there have been specific guides on the internet that said, look, this is a good recruitment time for us. These QAnon supporters are disillusioned, just like we were disillusioned. They like Donald Trump, just like we kind of like Donald Trump. We use him as a means to an end. We can go and bring those people in right now. We can recruit them. That's where it gets dangerous.
That is concerning. One of the largest QAnon groups on Telegram closed comments after the inauguration to let everyone, as they said, take a breather. And Ron Watkins, the former administrator for the message board 8kun, posted a note to his many, many followers telling them that they needed to, quote, go back to our lives as best we are able. What do these messages mean for the future of Q?
it won't go away in any traditional sense. Maybe they'll stop believing that there is a government insider named Q who has access to information. Clearly, this guy has failed them over and over again. I'm sure some people will move past that. But there's too much money to be made in this grift. And frankly, there's too much identity wrapped up in it. It helps them cope with stuff. You know, people will find a new way to grift off this and make money off it. You know, sell T-shirts, sell books, get donations. But it may not just be called QAnon anymore. That's what we saw with Dominion, the Dominion voting systems conspiracy theory. That was pushed by QAnon conspiracy theorists first. And then it became sort of mainstream in the Republican Party. You'll see those network factions that were built up over the last 4 years through QAnon be deployed for other conspiracy theories.
So I'm sure there are people listening to you talk thinking this sounds absolutely ridiculous. But the fact is that QAnon has done all of these things and has in fact inspired real world violence. I mean, there were slogans and paraphernalia at the Capitol insurrection. At least two recently sworn in members of Congress have expressed support for QAnon. How do you think we got to this point?
There are several reasons. First of all, the prior administration, the Trump administration, kind of benefited from the existence of it. That's why Donald Trump would not denounce it. It was a really powerful tool for hatred of his enemies. That is not the case anymore. The government does not benefit from QAnon anymore. So it got that way from the administration who benefited off those people existing, even if they didn't explicitly endorse it. And then it got that way from social media companies who just refused to take it seriously. You know, that insurrection that happened on January 6th, people kept saying that this was going to happen. They kept posting on 8chan and 8con and on Facebook and on Instagram that they were going to storm the Capitol. And social media companies did not take it remotely seriously. Authorities didn't either. Now they realize this isn't all talk. You know, even if 98% of the time they don't, 2% of the time they do, and it's deadly and it's very serious.
And now that Trump is gone, the conspiracy theories are still there. Ben Collins covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org. Ben, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR, excuse me, in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.